llorado con pasión. Mira, estoy loco por tu amor.
Hey folks, welcome to this week's podcast. Okay, so this is one of those interesting kind of fill in the holes of the history of rock and roll guests. A couple months ago, I played a song by Keith Colley. I don't know where I found it, a 45 of Sugaree, which you'll hear later at the end of this interview. And then I saw his name as a songwriting credit on a song by Gary Lewis and the Playboys, and I started to see this guy's name everywhere, and I started to look into it, and it just turns out he's a guy who wrote tons of songs, not too many huge hits, but for quantity, this guy was like nobody, like 700 songs, and all of them got covers, and some of them multiple covers. So I found that he's still alive. I found him. I called him up. And so we chatted. So if you're interested in the history of 60s pop and the L.A. scene and just how guys wrote this many songs and got them to this many artists, well, this interview is for you, I think. So here he is, Keith Colley, super nice guy, interesting story. I hope you enjoy. All right, there is Keith Colley, our guest today. He recorded for VJ, Columbia, Challenge, White Whale, Era, Unical, and many more labels. Had songs covered by Rick Nelson, Gary Lewis and the Playboys, Gene Vincent, Tom Jones, Skeeter Davis, The New Beats, The Knickerbockers, Jackie DeShannon, The American Breed, The Browns, Gene McDaniel, Ray Barretto, Keely Smith, Pat Boone, Glenn Campbell, Bobby V. I mean, and more and more and more. Good morning. That's a long list. Now I'm out of breath. Keith Colley, good morning and welcome to the program.
Hi there. Great to be with you.
I believe you live in Washington State now, and is that where you grew up?
Actually, I did grow up on a wheat ranch in eastern Washington, and then I went to Seattle to the UW, and then it just so happened I got a recording contract in Seattle. Was transferred to a label in L.A., went to L.A., and started doing things.
Tell me about your childhood. Let's just go back one sec. I mean, was there, growing up on a farm, was there radio, was there a record player? What was going on musically in your house?
Nothing. It was strictly work on the ranch. It was up before sun came up and go out and do the chores and had livestock and do all the stuff, and then get the school bus, and then got off the school bus, did more chores. It wasn't music on the farm, but I was all about the farm and farming and ranching and stuff like that. But I did have I had my own high school dance bands in high school, and I started doing that probably about when I became a freshman, I guess, in high school.
So did you just pick up, what were you playing the guitar? Did you just pick it up by yourself, or did you have lessons, or...?
Yeah, I did. One of our hired hands on the ranch taught me a chord, and that's all it took for me to become interested. I picked up the guitar and started practicing, and then started playing the guitar and realizing that, why not write songs? So I started kind of writing songs at the same time, and that's how that started.
And this was okay with your folks? As long as you got your chores done, you were allowed to do music if you wanted?
Oh yeah. As long as the work got done, then we could do anything we wanted to. And so we had all the freedom we wanted to. And then of course, when I turned 16, I got my car, and that was then watch out.
It's all over.
Yeah.
Keith Colley on the loose. So you said that you attended University of Washington, and the story goes, and maybe you can tell me if this is accurate or not. The story is that you recorded a version of the popular Dion song "Teenager in Love" at a local radio station, and the station sort of started spinning your version, and that's how you sort of got to the attention of record labels. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I had a friend, and I went to CBC, Columbia Basin Junior College in the Tri-Cities. I had a friend who was the school journalist, and he did an article on me because I was doing some singing around in the area then, too. And he took me to the local disc jockey. His name was Lynn Bryson at the top pop station there. And I was in with Lynn one night, and he said, let me record you. And he says, what can you do? So I just pulled out my guitar and sang Dion's A Teenager in Love, my version. And he started playing it, and it's got tremendous reaction and request and everything. So then Lynn ended up telling a top record guy in Seattle about me. His name was Jerry Denon. And then actually I got a phone call from Jerry, and I was back up on the ranch. It was during harvest and working on the combine, and got a phone call from Jerry Denon in Seattle. So I went to see him, immediately signed a recording contract with Jerry, Jerden Records. So then I went ahead and moved over to UW and started doing drama and my different classes and stuff like that. And then Jerry connected me with someone that he had been working with. His name is Al DeLore, who was a record producer in Los Angeles. So I just went ahead and moved to Los Angeles because I could see that where things were going.
So how old were you at the time you moved to L.A.?
I was had to been maybe 18, 19 or something like that.
So you put out three records on the Era label, I believe. And, I mean, how do you describe the style of those records, what you were going for?
Well, I can only describe it as pop, top 40 sounding pop stuff. So it was just straight pop, I would say.
Yeah, straight pop, like top 40 sound of what was on the radio then. After that, you moved to Unical Records, and you made your first version of Enamorando, which became, in one of the songs, you're really very well known for. I believe it's around 1963, and it did get into the Billboard Top 100, and it's a song of yours that's been covered a million times. And again, the story of this one is that the producer liked the song, but thought the lyrics might be a tad bland, so he translated them into Spanish, and once you sang it into Spanish, it was kind of a magical record all of a sudden.
It became magic, pure magic. We decided, the melody was very, very commercial sounding. The lyrics didn't match the melody, wasn't as good as the melody. So my producer, great, brilliant producer by the name of Al Allen, and Al DeLore had taken me over to see him. He said, well, let's do it in Spanish. And I said, well, I don't speak Spanish. I don't speak a word of Spanish. Hola, maybe. That's about it. And so he said, I don't care about that. And so we got a person that, a Spanish person, and we translated sort of as close as you can anyway, because you can't get perfect translation. But we translated the English lyrics of the song, which was titled Falling in Love. And we picked out the best sounding Spanish words that would sound the best to English speaking people, such as myself and everybody else in the room. And came up with the title that became Enamorado, which means in love, basically, in Spanish. And so we did it, and it became a hit in L.A. and other places, and became a national hit, and actually created a lot of attention internationally because it was a Spanish, a different language.
The song was so popular that it got re-released on the White Whale label a few years later, and then you re-recorded it for Columbia, I think, right?
Columbia. Yeah, I did with Jerry, with Gary Usher, who is a friend of mine. He basically sort of helped start the Beach Boys. Gary was my producer. In that session, the reason I really liked that session was because we recorded another song called Shame, Shame, which Glenn Campbell, who did all, as a musician, did most of my sessions, sang the harmony on, and turned out to be a pretty good sounding recording. And then that picked up by producer Steve Rowland in England, who recorded it with a group called the Magic Lanterns, and it was a hit there, and then it became a hit over in the States as well.
Yeah. So tell me about working with Gary Usher, because I know he worked, after the Beach Boys, he worked at Columbia sort of as an A&R guy and produced the Byrds and I think a bunch of other acts. So what kind of a guy was he?
He was a serious guy, quiet, good writer, good songwriter, but he was very, he was kind of a serious guy, very kind of a quiet guy, but very profound and definitely knew the industry well because he had started at a pretty young age himself and getting involved with getting the Beach Boys going and all of that scene. So he was really up to speed on everything.
You put out a record out on VJ, Welcome Home Baby. I believe it was co-written with P.F. Sloan and recorded at Gold Star. We had him on the show just before he passed away, and a super unusual guy, super interesting. What was he like back in 1965?
Very, very talented. He and a friend of his, I was with, I was sitting in Unical Records, and they came in and wanted to see me, and I didn't know why, but they said, why don't we do some writing together? Well, I didn't know him, but I said, well, it just so happens I've got a song that I'm starting to write. It's called Welcome Home, Baby. And I've got the main part, but I'm stuck on the bridge because I'm not really a musician's musician. I write basic chords to write songs with, but he said, well, because we went to the piano, and he said, well, here's your chord, and he played the chord, and we got the bridge, and so one of my favorite songs I've written, and so he and I wrote the song.
So as time went on, like you say, you were writing more songs and sort of started spending more of your energy, I think, as a writer than as a performer, and that huge list of artists, it really is only a small percentage of the folks that covered some of your songs. I guess part of that is because after the Beatles, maybe the model of the one guy singing alone was kind of changing, and groups were sort of more in, and you were able to provide songs. So it seemed like you were just writing like crazy. Am I wrong to think? Yeah, I mean, how many songs?
I've written as a songwriter. I don't know. I've got in my bio 700 songs, but it's a lot more than that, actually. I think Dolly Parton said she wrote 5,000, but I can see that. I can see how that happens, because if you're writing constantly, you're always writing, and you get a great idea. Well, then you have to write it, because if you don't, somebody else is going to do it, and that's the way that works. But when I went with signed with Four Star Music as an exclusive songwriter, I started producing demos and sessions, and doing a lot of producing for Challenge Records and Four Star Music. And so when you're a writer and you're fortunate enough to be with a company that lets you do anything you want as far as making demos and producing sessions goes, which was my status there, then you do a lot of recordings. I mean, I had some production people, a group of musicians. Most of them were mostly the Champs, Jimmy Seals, Dash Cross, and Glenn Campbell. They were singers, musicians in most of my sessions. And so we would do when you can all sing and everything, and you can do things pretty fast, we would turn out like four complete sessions in one day, and we would do a couple of those a week, if you're writing enough, that is, and they're good enough. So the advantage of being a writer is when you're prolific and you do a lot of sessions is, well, then something's going to happen, and some of those are going to turn out to be masters. So you have the numbers are there, so you you have a lot of, not only do you have a lot of songs to show a lot of people with the demos, but you have a lot of potential masters in the making by doing the demos that actually turn out as masters. So you increase your capability of producing, you know, acceptable recordings by creating a lot of demos, producing a lot of demos.
So you were writing, I don't know, 16 songs a week and making demos with these guys and working at Challenge and Four Star, and they would send the demos out and these folks, I mean, would they make little 7-inch acetates, or how did they do it?
Yeah, we had his name was Ellery, and he was our guy in the office. That's all he did. He had a cutting machine, and he would just cut these demos on these acetates. That was his full-time job, and so we had a lot of we had the capability of getting a lot of recordings to a lot of producers in town and artists and record people. But now, of course, we have MP3s you can send with the push of a button, so it's, you don't have to go through all that.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's interesting about your catalog, especially in that very busy period, is that the styles, you know, there's kind of flower power songs and pop songs and rock and roll songs and bubblegummy songs and kind of folky songs and psychedelic. It kind of is all over the map. So were you writing for particular artists, or
you don't do it that way. It's a... you can do it that way, sure. And then when opportunity presents itself, if you know somebody who's an artist and looking for follow-ups and stuff like that, that's always good. But what you do is I made it sort of a policy to not write for artists, but to write for the song. Because it's always the most important thing is the song. The song is the most important, powerful communication vehicle there is. And the song is the most, when it comes to emotional intelligence that imprints in the frontal lobe of the brain, there's nothing that imprints like the song. That's why songs are so powerful. So you always write, I always wrote for the song and got an idea for a song, then worried about, first you write it and make sure that it's right and it's good, and good enough to spend money and time to go make a demo of it. Then when you get that and then you figure out, well, who can you show it to? Who's the most appropriate artist and labels and producers to show it to? And you do that. And then when you start getting different... So I wrote all genres. I mean, I wrote... it didn't matter to me. And I did that purposely to stretch my songwriting capability, too. But the good thing about getting a lot of records with different styles and artists on a song is you end up with... different kinds of recordings and styles of recordings on that song. So then you have, say, if you have a person that does things a certain way, maybe a bluesy delivery, then you have a demo of interpretation of that particular song that you can show to all those people in that category. So it's a matter of geometrics taking effect.
Some of the songs you wrote were covered multiple times. Like One Track Mind is one that's, there's just so many versions of that, you know, it's kind of like a garage rock almost song.
Yeah.
That must be one of your more successful ones. I was listening today to Jerry Fuller's I Get Carried Away, and I was thinking, as a songwriter, you make a demo, even if it's a great demo, but a record like that, which is so fully realized with the strings and stuff, it must have been sort of delightful to make these, you know, to write a song on a guitar, make a demo, and then months later maybe hear this giant record come out.
It always is to see your song fulfilled the way that you envision it. And you mentioned that particular song, and Jerry did that. And so that gave us a great demo to show to Tom Jones. And Tom Jones recorded that song on one of his albums because it was sort of done the way Tom would do it.
I noticed that L. Colley is a huge co-writer of yours. Is that your wife? Is that who that was?
Linda, my wife, yeah. Went out with her and taught her how to write songs, and she turned into just a nonstop writing machine. Just an amazing writer, very talented, and stories.
One of the stories that I unfortunately hear too often is from people who had bad deals, or you know, because there's so much. So much money and cash in the music business, especially back then, that there's also a lot of guys trying to get that money. It sounds like you sort of had a pretty easy go, or was there some bad deals as well?
Very, very easy. Very easy, because when you're with a company that Gene Autry started, and Gene Autry sort of started the music industry too, you know, him and Roy Rogers, the Singing Cowboys, and the Gold Records and that whole thing, then you have clout. In other words, one time, Columbia Records put out a record, and someone else claimed to be the writer of it. And so we called them up and said, okay, and they just had a number one record with the guy who claimed to be the writer of this song. Well, all I had to say was, I have some original manuscripting that I've done with ink, and this is how you learn stuff, and there's no problem at all proving that I am the writer of this song, and I've got the stuff to prove it. See, when you do stuff in ink, I mean, this is what I would tell if I was giving songwriting classes, this would be one of my topics, then you can test the age of the ink. And you can test when something's been written. So I had all that stuff, and I make it a practice to do that. And they stopped the record instantaneously until they had my name on it.
So someone else just decided to put their name on one of your songs and thought nothing would happen?
That's right, and I've had that happen more than once. By showing somebody something before you've copywritten it and recorded it and stuff like that or demoed it. So it is always a temptation out there. But as far as the guys that really got in trouble was sort of a generation before me. I mean, there was a lot of cases where someone would sign an artist and take all their songs and give them a few bucks or something like that. And then they'd maybe get a hit or something or record some really classic stuff, and then they'd get killed, and they would actually kill them. And that was that happened more than once, and to quite a few people in back in the day.
Amazing.
So, because of the money involved and all the aspects.
Yeah. Well, do you have regrets, career wise?
Well, I have a lot of regrets career-wise, but the thing is, when I go back and look at one thing, then I think, well, yeah, but then this other thing wouldn't have happened. If I, you know, and you never know where a particular road's going to take you. You can get in trouble just as easily as you can have success down a particular road. So I don't think about the regrets. Well, that's basically because I'm very engaged and very busy doing my own multimedia projects, so I don't have time for that kind of stuff anyway, because that's just too counterproductive. So you keep marching forward and using your experience and your knowledge to create new stuff, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, it seems like you are just from the moment go. I mean, it's from singing Teenager in Love in whatever that was, 1959 or something, to now. It seems like you've never really stopped. Tell folks a little bit. I know you're working on this multimedia project called CanDo. Can you just tell us a little bit about what that is?
It's called CanDo. It's CanDo is an acronym for creating a new dimension of optimism. It's all about. It's called the CanDo Project, and it just empowers CanDo kids to reach their highest potential. The Senate, Washington State Senate, has passed a CanDo Kids bill, and the House of Representatives, the CanDo Kids bill for being positive role models everywhere. And Los Angeles, the mayor and all the city council named the CanDo Kids project the most inspirational project in Los Angeles. So I'm working on that, but it has to do with right now I've got about 39 or 40 live websites up that take you on a tour through Constellation CanDo. Constellation CanDo is the achievement universe found in one's own imagination. It will develop into a new social media called the AV, CanDoAvenue.com, and renewing the American spirit. That's SpiritOfAmerica.com, and has to do with a program for veterans, with an album that I want to produce with vets from across the country called the American Song Series. There's nothing like it, and it's definitely very unique. And pretty soon we'll be able to have the AV membership live so that people can have a membership on the AV, CanDo Avenue, and post and their projects and create economic development on the AV from their products. And, of course, portions of proceeds go to charities, and also help CanDo kids everywhere.
I want to play the song Sugary, Sugar Every Day and Night Girl. Tell me about that song. Where did it come from? What was the idea? How long did it take to
write? Sugary. Boy, I wrote that with a friend of mine, Dick Monda, who was with Four Star, and he wrote some songs, and he was a writer there. And we just went in and did that and made a demo of it, sort of one of my favorite songs, actually. I haven't thought about that song for years, but Sugary, and Dick Mond and I wrote the song, and another example of somebody that had a different set of chords, so it put me in the position to be able to write a different kind of song.
Well, did you guys write this in one afternoon, or?
Yeah, we did, yeah.
Well, Keith Colley, it's so interesting to hear stories like yours, and you know, the music business is so fascinating, and you've worked with so many people. I really appreciate you taking a minute to fill us in today.
Well, it's fun, and I appreciate it.
Well, thanks. Let's hear Sugar Ree.
Hey, great talking with you.
Thank you.
Talking this way.